Us, Larry Richard with anchorman Paul Rasmussen. As we get ready to end the month, it has been challenging in the last 2 days, to say the least, for so many, related to this mid-air collision that took the lives of 67 people with an American Airlines jet, a regional jet, and a military U.S. Army Black Hawk helicopter with three on board there, 60 and four crew members on the passenger jet. And joining us from Washington, CBS's Eleanor Watson. Eleanor, good morning.
Good morning.
The details, you know, starting to come in from different resources. One of the things that is going to be talked about and already is going to be a discussion item is the fact that I understand Reagan International Airport was built to accommodate 15 million passengers a year. There are 25 million now, in Congress voted last year to raise that. So there are and have been concerns about the air traffic. But that said, what's the latest from Washington on your end?
Well, that's right. The congressional members have made warnings about this pretty much in the past year as that vote was going down, because there were two near misses last year. But the latest from this crash is that the Army has recovered one of the three soldiers' bodies, the two other bodies, the one of one male pilot and of a female pilot, are still trapped in the helicopter. And so when recovery operations begin again today, they will be efforting to get those two bodies out, as well as find the black box in the Black Hawk helicopter. We learned last night that NTSB, National Transportation Safety Board investigators, did find the two black boxes in the passenger plane. And so that will be crucial as investigators start to figure out how this collision happened.
And I understand that air traffic was resumed yesterday, but a lot of people are on edge right now because of the situation where they're finding out about those two near misses and just the amount of traffic that's in that area. What are the officials saying down there to assure the flying public that they're safe now?
Well, President Trump at the podium yesterday said that there should be no concern about flying. This was an anomaly. We have a lot of traffic, very congested area, and this tragic crash was an anomaly. I think today we'll be asking a lot of the FAA and about the air traffic controllers. We've learned that at least two of the air traffic controllers on the night of this crash were doing more jobs than they're used to at that hour. And so I think the FAA will focus on that today and make sure that air traffic control is properly staffed so that everyone can resume flying with less concern, hopefully.
Eleanor, the helicopter that collided with this passenger jet, was it based anywhere near Reagan National Airport?
It was. It was out of the 12th Aviation Battalion in Fort Belvoir, Virginia, which is just south of D.C. And we learned that it was doing an annual training exercise, a nighttime exercise they have to do at least every year. That makes it sound like training, as if someone's learning how to fly a helicopter. That's not what this is. This is a training of a very specific mission, a continuity of government mission, which is what this battalion trains for in case there is a disaster in D.C. and they have to transport senior officials out, like the Secretary of Defense, executive leaders. That's what they were training for on the night of the crash. They are based out of Fort Belvoir, Virginia, which is just south of the Reagan Airport.
And we heard the new Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth say yesterday that obviously they're investigating all aspects of this. But to your point, that's a very important point indeed, that this was not some, you know, new pilots training. It was a specific mission by experienced pilots, correct?
That's right. He called them a fairly experienced crew. We talked to Army officials yesterday who said they were a very experienced crew, that they would have known this route that they were flying along the Potomac, where the Potomac River curves towards Reagan Airport. As they're going south, they would have flown this route multiple times. That is a route that is flown daily, regularly. And so what is confounding is how something that is so regular and routine turned into the collision that we saw.
Eleanor, about the American Airlines regional jet that was inbound, my understanding is that air traffic control had it coming in on one runway, and then they altered the course for another one. Do you know anything more about that?
That's what I've heard from my CBS News colleagues, that there are two runways when you approach from the south, and they were scheduled to land on one, were switched just before to land on the other. That will be part of the investigation, I imagine, of if that complicated communication between the air traffic control talking to the helicopter and to the passenger plane.
And this occurred about 400 feet above the Potomac, with the Army Black Hawk helicopter following the river, as we understand it, as it was coming. And then the inbound jet, as you said, heading for one of the landing strips at Reagan International Airport. Eleanor, appreciate the update. Thank you.
Thank you.
Eleanor Watson, who covers the Pentagon and stories in Washington from CBS.
So I gather, Larry, from her detailed report on the nearby helicopter base, that there's probably a lot of chopper traffic along the Potomac and near Reagan National Airport.
Yeah, and the new information there was the fact that this was an exercise, and Pete Hegseth, our new defense secretary, said they were wearing night vision goggles, which may or may not have played a role in this, and it was a exercise in case there was a disaster. Ironically,
I didn't know that,
to pick up our elected officials, like the defense secretary.
Mm-hmm.
They would send in a Black Hawk to get him and other officials out, and that's what the exercise was apparently all about. So we'll continue to bring you more information as they continue to try to recover the additional bodies. 40 bodies have been recovered to this point. Stories that are driving the news each weekday afternoon, brought to you by Service Master of Greater Pittsburgh. When disaster strikes, demand the yellow van. Check out Colin Dunlap from 2 to 6 this afternoon. In between, Marty Griffin has got a lot of new information today as we continue to follow this story of the midair collision.
Hey, Larry.
In Washington.
We have a caller. His name is Bruce. He was in the Air Force, and he was a policeman. And he has some really great insight on the night vision goggles.
Bruce, good morning. Welcome to KDKA.
Good morning, Larry. I just heard the report that the helicopter pilot had night vision goggles on. I served in the Air Force for 28 years as a military police officer, and I was an Afghan vet.
Well, thank you for your service, first and foremost.
You are quite welcome. You're quite welcome. When you are flying or driving with night vision goggles, your depth perception is off quite a bit. Something you think is far away is actually a lot closer. And that's something we had in training. And I'm sure our Air Force pilots and our Army pilots, Marine Corps, Navy pilots are trained that way. But it is very deceiving when you wear night vision goggles how far something is away or closer. So it is difficult. You have to take that into consideration. I drove Hummers and in the Air Force, and you have to watch very closely when you're driving because of the distortion of the night vision goggles. You can see at night, but again, your depth perception is off.
Well, that's interesting you bring that point up. A couple of things. Paul, this collision occurred 400 feet above the Potomac River.
But we know the helicopters are supposed to fly at 200.
And then they have the audio from the tower telling the Black Hawk helicopter that they were, you know, to a maneuver and go behind this approaching jet.
Right. That, again, the distortion of the night vision, if they were flying with night vision goggles.
Well, that's what the defense secretary said, yes.
Yes. So, again, depth perception, how close you are, or, you know, the front of the aircraft or the back of the aircraft, I'm sure the investigation will determine perhaps that might have been a contributing factor to that terrible accident.
So rare an accident like this, and we've mentioned it, there hasn't been a commercial aviation crash in this country since 2009. near Buffalo. Well, so it's been a long time. They're just trying to piece all this together and why it happened.
Correct. Helicopters and planes rarely crash. However, I do recall Senator Hines dying in a helicopter that crashed with an airplane.
Oh, yeah.
I believe Senator Hines did crash. His helicopter did crash with a aircraft, and he died.
That was like 35 years ago, something like
that. Yes, but I do remember that. Yeah, showing my age. But, yes, I do remember that. But it's very rare that a helicopter and plane crash. But it's, does happen, unfortunately.
Well, Bruce, we appreciate your input. Thank you.
You know, to Bruce's point, to Bruce's point there, Larry, mid-air collisions are rare, period, of any kind. I mean, this is the first time in as long as I can remember we've had a mid-air.
Which is pretty remarkable based on the number of flights there are in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And when we first started talking to Eleanor Watson, the reporter in Washington, one of the things that I saw that stuck in my mind is that Reagan International Airport was built to accommodate about 15 million people a year.
Yeah.
And they have been raising that threshold for years, and most recently 25 million passengers. So all approaching double what it was actually designed to handle now. And Congress had just voted to increase, because it's so convenient for them, right? It's right there. You literally can see the Capitol,
mm-hmm.
the Pentagon, and the White House.
I can attest to how stretched the facility is. The last time I flew through Reagan, it was a regional jet flight, and they had an area where they pooled most of the gates together. And we were like shoulder to shoulder in the waiting area, several thousand people. I would imagine a couple thousand boarding, you know, various flights, maybe 15 to 20 different regional jets. It seemed like to me it was very overcrowded. And I know that they've, you know, added on to Reagan on either side of the original terminal, which is a beautiful old Art Deco facility.
You know what it reminds me of there? You weren't around in Pittsburgh. We used to have a place downtown called Jenkins Arcade. It's like a throwback to your point, Art Deco. It used to be like a mini indoor mall right in the city, not too far from where we used to be at Gateway Center. But that was the place to go. But it had that same look, same feel. Obviously much smaller. But, they've got the black boxes from the jet. They're looking for the one from the Black Hawk helicopter. But there's probably enough anecdotal reasoning what happened here that obviously some miscalculation.
And there's been a change. We have some new information, Larry, that I'll be passing along. I've got to work on it before I say anything about it. But we have a new report from CBS News about the air traffic control situation. It's not exactly what we've been saying up until now. There's been a change in that. So I'll pass that along when we get to 7:30.
All right, and two sources confirmed to CBS News that one air traffic controller was doing the work of two at the time of the collision, and three soldiers on board. CBS Skyler Henry heard from the NTSB.
The NTSB has indicated that their investigation will be three things: thorough, steady, and meticulous. They say that this is the first full day that they are able to get a full grasp on exactly what happened, saying that crews are still in the recovery process trying to get as many bodies as possible.
And at this point, authorities have recovered 40 bodies intact. Unfortunately, pieces of several others, some fragments have washed ashore. Horribly, investigators believe they've accessed all the remains they can safely retrieve to this point, but believe there are more in a tail section of the fuselage currently out of reach, and they are hoping that they will be able to do that as the light of day resumes now in our nation's capital. Came morning show, and we welcome Chris Johnson in studio, who is the co-CEO of Teletracking. Appreciate you coming in, Chris. I think it's going to be fascinating for people in the region to know you're here, why you're here, and how long this company has been here. Pittsburgh, we hear, is this tech center, and it has been growing more recently But this company has been in Pittsburgh and founded here in 1991.
Thank you for having me. 1991, Teletracking was founded. We just celebrated a major milestone January of this year, went into our 35th year.
And we reached out to you because of the technology and the ability that you have. And we want to highlight periodically what is being done here in Pittsburgh. And in this case, give us the elevator pitch on Teletracking.
Teletracking. Yes. As I mentioned, founded in 1991 by Michael Zamias right here in Pittsburgh. Teletracking is a logistics company. You think of logistics of Amazon and things being moved around. We're a logistics company in healthcare. And we manage and focus inside and outside of the hospital. We manage the workflows of patients, staff, assets, all of the key components with a cloud-based platform, AI-enabled, which we'll talk about a little bit later. But just as importantly, the best practices we've developed with working over 1,000 hospitals across multiple countries over that time.
Yeah, you said you just got back from Germany and you're overseas, so you're part of the team that travels, obviously. I can't imagine there's any organization in healthcare that couldn't benefit from streamlining some of their workflows to maximize the savings and benefits on the output, because there are great challenges, as you know, financially, especially now in healthcare.
There are some differences between countries. As you mentioned, just got back from Germany. We operate in the U.S., Canada, U.K., and Germany. We're expanding out beyond that. There may be different systems in place, but you're right. Every hospital needs to improve efficiency. And we work with the largest in the world, 200 hospitals here right in the U.S., down to small community systems, and make an impact, improving efficiency, productivity. We increase their revenues at the same time we help them contain their costs.
I mean, that's the perfect fit. That's what everybody in business is looking for, right?
Everyone in business is looking for it. Healthcare has a unique difference in that we're talking about people. And when you think about revenues, if you're in the U.S. and it's different in different parts of the country, that is a proxy for serving more patients within the context of the healthcare systems.
Well, you're in a place, why Pittsburgh, where we are Eds and Meds now, used to be known obviously for steel, but I don't think people are aware of how many technology-based companies are actually here.
A lot of technology companies. You've got a tremendous Pittsburgh Tech Council, which supports the community, great universities that are producing great talent coming out. But there's still, you know, if you look at the history of Pittsburgh, it's a history of entrepreneurial spirit. It's a history of innovation. This is just the next iteration of it from my perspective.
That said, there has been an exponential advance in computer software and science. We hear every day of the week, artificial intelligence. I just spent Wednesday evening with Oren Etzioni, who is not a household name, but people in that world know he's one of the foremost authorities on this. And simple question is, when you're asked, Chris, what is artificial intelligence and how are you utilizing it?
So the way that we're utilizing it, it's actually interesting. My team hears me say this on a regular basis. Teletracking did not go in with a AI or artificial intelligence strategy. We have an outcome strategy. How can we produce better outcomes for our clients and our customers and their patients? We've applied this technology, which is a learning technology. It takes large data sets and is able to parse through them and do things faster than we've traditionally been able to do. And if you look at the processing capacity and the speed of which computing power is moving ahead, it allows us to take a very large data set of information that we've learned, hindsight, information that we're seeing now, insight, and provide more foresight, you know, what is going to happen next. The unique combination and how Teletracking is using that combination is, as I mentioned, Teletracking is a logistics company. So we've created an incredibly large amount of operational data over 1,000 clients over 35 years. We make things move with our system. We inform people what's next, what is the next best action for them to take. And with the implementation of AI into our platform, We're increasingly taking that forward in more intelligent ways. And if I can give, I'll give you an example.
Sure. I'd love one.
If that's all right, Larry. There's two different ways, and Teletracking just announced this week a partnership with a company called Faculty.ai, which is the leading applied AI company in the United Kingdom, and we worked very closely with them there. We are now bringing this back to the United States and other markets that are there. But there's two areas that we're focused on and using the AI solution. One is in scenario planning, right? And there's a lot of what-ifs in the world, a lot of variability, as you know, in healthcare. It's there, whether you're talking about capacity, your staffing, your volumes, things of that nature. But Teletracking is coupled with that with our platform that, as I mentioned before, makes things move in a hospital. We'll send a transporter to pick up this patient. We'll tell a nurse that this patient is ready for discharge, things of that nature. So the individual bits and pieces, all the way down to the people that clean the beds and make them ready for the next patient. So a combination of scenario planning, what if, and what are the various things that are happening, coupled with our ability now to be more predictive in what's going to happen, is changing that what if to a when. You know, not what if this happens, when this happens, and how you go about dealing with it. And so our system allows you to identify, based on the variables that are in play, here are the outcomes that I'm trying to achieve. We will then give you a blueprint. This transporter needs to move this patient. This patient needs to be discharged. Here's what's coming in your emergency department. And we allow for better decisions throughout the process.
And ultimately, if you streamline that, you can save money because it's more organized and less chaos.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, efficiency, listen, in economic terms, efficiency and productivity cures a lot of ills. And unfortunately, healthcare has lagged behind, and not because people are not trying and not because we don't have wonderful people working in this industry.
Right.
It's a human business, right? We're not making widgets. We're dealing with human beings that are moving through a process, and it's very dynamic. These tools and these capabilities allow them to work to the top of their license and do the best work that they can do.
Plus, at the same time, these people all have to deal with the bureaucracy and regulations and all the things that go into making decisions about what they're allowed to do, what they're going to get compensated for doing, and it's really complicated. So after 35 years, you should have some idea, right?
If you're still here. It's extraordinarily complicated. Trust me, when we entered the German market, I thought the U.S. regulation was difficult. It was even more challenging.
Really?
But it, even beyond the regulatory, Larry, I think that there's real challenges in the introduction of technologies such as the EMR, the electronic medical record, which was mandated a number of years ago, which has put a huge burden on clinicians.
Well, we'll talk more about that. We're with Chris Johnson, co-CEO of Teletracking, in studio on the Big K Morning Show. This is the Big K Morning Show. Larry Richard with our in-studio guest. Chris Johnson is the co-CEO of Teletracking right here in Pittsburgh for 35 years in the healthcare space, logistics company, trying to create better outcomes and efficiencies that save money and, in this case, hopefully get people better, too, at the same time.
Serve more people. That is our goal. No patient should ever have to wait for the care that they need.
And that's one of the crises in healthcare right there. If you have to go to the emergency room, the wait time sometimes can be unimaginable. And I'm sure you hear this all the time. Hey, Chris, can you help us streamline this with 1,000 hospitals? I'm sure you've heard that a few times.
Heard it many times, and is different levels of, pardon the pun, acuity. I mean, if you look in the UK where we operate as well, 7.5 million people are on the waiting list for care today. 7.5 million.
That's on a waiting list.
On a waiting list, and there. Listen, we believe there's a couple of things. If you think about the cost of healthcare and the way it's skyrocketing, U.S. and other places, if I were, knowing what I know now, about the work that Teletracking has done. And I came from a very large multinational before joining up with Teletracking because I saw the impact that they could have. When I came to Teletracking and I explained to my friends and family, why are we doing this? There's really two things that they need to know personally. One, look at the cost of your healthcare. You may have an employer that's paying that insurance continues to go up. You may pay your own out-of-pocket expenses, and it continues to go up. And we're one of the most per capita spending the most on healthcare, but we're operating at the bottom of the list of the 50 countries that are reviewed here. Thank goodness for Azerbaijan, or we would be at the bottom of the list. And so the efficiency and productivity that is there, why does it matter to an individual? Cost is huge.
Right. That's all we hear, cost of healthcare.
Pushing over 20% of our gross domestic product is going into healthcare. The second one is more personal, and I was visiting with my father over the holidays a year ago. I had a terrible accident. I went to a hospital that did not have teletracking, and the personal experience of the wait times, the confusion, the understanding what's next. I mean, if anybody's been through this process, it's extraordinarily difficult when you're probably at one of your weakest moments. But a hospital that has teletracking inside of it, what we can tell you is that you will have visibility to what's happening. You will know where you are in that process. You will be informed. And the staff that are working with you will be in a position to help you better. And so I've always told my friends, before you go to the hospital, you should ask them, do you run teletracking?
Chris Johnson, co-CEO of Teletracking right here in Pittsburgh. Really fascinating. Really appreciate your time. The time flew, but would love to have you back sometime. And great to meet somebody who's part of this whole explosion of technology that we hear about, even though this company's been here for 35 years.
Yep. Thank you very much for having me, and thank you for your participation in Mission of Mercy last year. It was a great event, and people like you contributing in our community is
a huge honor and pleasure. For what you and your team do in Mission of Mercy is fantastic, with the health care provided and people's anxieties relieved. So great to meet you, Chris.
Thank you very much, Larry. Have a good day.